SNI Digital Innovations in Learning in association with the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery, Lindy Liao, the chairwoman, and its faculty are pleased to bring to you the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery 101 Lecture Series on Neurosurgery and Clinical and Basic Neuroscience. This series of lectures are provided free to bring advances in clinical and basic neuroscience to physicians and patients everywhere. One out of every five people in the world suffer from a neurologically related disease. This lecture and discussion will be on the evolution of U.S. neurosurgery resident education. A brief look back, a long look at the present, and a preview of the future. It will be given by Richard Byrne, the Roger C. Bone Presidential Professor and Chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, Illinois.
Today, I'm very pleased to announce that we have a visiting professor, Dr. Richard Byrne. Byrne is the Roger C. Bone Presidential Professor and Chair of the Department of Neurosurgery at Rush University. I learned last night that he's been chair for 18 years, so you must have started when you were 30. He actually did his MD at Northwestern, and then his residency at Rush, and then pretty much has stayed there ever since. And he's just a renaissance person within neurosurgery. He's published over 150 papers and various book chapters and textbooks. He is co-PI of an NIH-funded intracortical visual prosthesis clinical trial for the treatment of blindness, which we may hear a little bit more about today. And he's also been very active in neurosurgery. He's been the president of the NSA. He's director of the ABNS. He's been on the board of the CNS, is currently on the board of directors of the ABNS, of the AANS. And he was treasurer of the SNS and will be president, or actually is president-elect of the SNS, which is our national, educational society. So, I'm very interested to hear his first talk, which is on the evolution of U.S. neurosurgical residency education. So let's give Dr. Byrne a warm welcome.
Thanks, everyone, for the invitation. Linda, thank you very much for the invitation. It's an honor to be with you. I know the faculty here pretty well. I've interviewed, I think, roughly a third of the residents, so I've gotten to know a fair amount of the residents as well. I've never been to the campus. It's very impressive. This is a really top-flight residency program, and it's an honor to be invited here. I've got two talks for you today. The first one is really meant to inform the residents of what you're going through and to maybe get the faculty caught up in all of the changes that have happened in U.S. neurosurgery education in the last decade, and then hopefully to stir up a little bit of debate about what's been good, what hasn't been good, what's going to happen in the future, and just to get people talking. The second one is just pure fun. The second one is really just to inspire the residents to get involved in the artificial intelligence revolution that's about to happen here. So let's go ahead and get started. These are my disclosures. As Linda pointed out, I've seen resident education from every possible angle as a resident program director, department chair for 18 years. And then the variety of things that I've done with Linda and Langston and others in national neurosurgery. So I'm going to try to give all those perspectives, leaning more towards the national perspective to explain why some things happened. I also have gone through the entire SNS archives. So I'm going to have some references to the archives from the old days, just for fun and just to give you some perspective. I'm going to be referencing these seven papers that I was co-author on in the last 3 years on U.S. neurosurgery education. And these websites, these are all publicly available, the ACGME websites, the SNS and the ABNS websites, and the milestones. So all of those are there for your reference at any time. So we'll start off with a little bit of history. So we'll take a look at early neurosurgical education, which was really entirely apprenticeship-based. And, you know, at our institution, it was started by Dean DeWitt Lewis, who was the first vice president of the SNS. Harvey Cushing was the first president of the SNS. He was doing transfacial and transsphenoidal surgery 100 some years ago. And there was no residency program. The first residency program was started by Adrian Verbruggen, who came from Mayo. And that, again, was entirely an apprenticeship model. And then Eric Olberg really formalized it and fused it with the UIC program. And it was all entirely observational and apprenticeship with a county experience and then a private experience across the street, which is similar to most programs back in those days. The available textbooks were very, very sparse. In fact, I own most of them because some of the senior faculty at our place, when they would retire, they knew I wanted them. So I've had a look at most of these things, and there really wasn't much. The diagrams were very, very sparse, almost no imaging and so on. And as far as multimodality education, it almost didn't exist. The SNS was really a traveling club, people going from institution to institution, watching each other operate, and then doing some video. And that was available really just to a select few within the SNS to see how everyone else did what they did. So when you consider the ideal principles of resident education with progressive responsibility, physicianship, technical skill training, multimodality education, a broad volume of operative cases, and following the science of learning and memory, the things that we think about today, virtually none of it existed at the time. I'm going to give you just a historical perspective. Some of you may have heard of Paul Busey. Paul Busey was chairman of neurosurgery at Northwestern. I've always been a fan of Paul Busey because I was a medical student there, and his portraits are everywhere and everyone would point to them and so on. But he was president of the SNS, president of the Academy, I'm sorry, the AANS, and the chair of the ABNS. So just listen to Paul Busey. Kemp Clark here is interviewing Paul Busey back in about 1980. Paul Busey saw just the evolution of neurosurgery from starting in 1927 to finishing in the 1980s. So listen to his perspective. Seems not to be.
I came to Chicago immediately after my internship at the Ford Hospital in Detroit. That was in 1928. I was Percival Bailey's first president. But when I arrived in Chicago, Percival Bailey was desperately ill with mumps and encephalitis. And
that gets it off the ground.
As the only other member of the department, I took over neurosurgery.
PGY2,
I performed my
the only neurosurgeon in the hospital.
At the request of the neurologist, Roy Granker, and the head of general surgery, Dallas Femister, in October of 1928. They had a patient they thought had a brain tumor. And although I had never operated on my own before, I had learned how to open a skull from the neurosurgeon at the Ford Hospital. He was a slow operator, and the other residents and interns at the Ford Hospital did not like to assist him because it took too long. So I took over and assisted him on most of his operations during that time. We had to spend a month in pathology.
Can you show me how to do
it? So I arrived.
Yeah. So you get an idea. What am I doing here?
You just want to mute.
Mute here?
Yeah.
Is that better? Good. All right. So you get an idea of early neurosurgery. Very, very poor supervision, very little oversight. And by the way, Percival Bailey was the chairman of neurosurgery at the University of Chicago in 1928. He had done one operation in his training, one operation. He did that with Harvey Cushing, literally one trigeminal neuralgia operation. He spent his entire residency in the lab working on brain tumor research. So that was the level of supervision. And, you know, thankfully, it's all evolved from there. And I think that if you think about Paul Busey, I'm sure he would be very, very in favor of what's evolved. And that is progressive responsibility and lower supervision over time. Nobody is starting off as a PGY2 unassisted anymore. And I think he'd also agree, from what I've heard of him, with the idea of competencies. I did my entire residency in the pre-competency era. These are all things that were implicitly understood and that you were supposed to learn it somehow, but really weren't explicitly taught. I think that he probably would agree with oversight from a national standpoint. This is what residency programs go through now. Every year, a self-study, and then every 10 years, a site visit. So I think he'd probably also find this to be a bit bureaucratic and overbearing, and this is what we go through now. So when I think about problems in neurosurgery resident education from the time that I became a residency program director in 2005, there were internal and external problems. The internal problems, I would just say, were variability in education between programs, some with better educational programs than others, very little simulation training. It was tough to define what a good resident was. You just say, well, that's a good resident. It was kind of hard to say why. We weren't really good at showing residents the way to success. Written and oral boards, I think, were a mess. The written boards, if they're looking really at factoids. And oral boards, anybody could show up with any case and could fail you on that case with no standardization. And we didn't really have much of a way to show people earlier in their practice. So if someone finishes their residency and they're floundering in their first couple of years, we had ways of finding out who that person was and punishing them, but not really helping them. And there wasn't any organization in neurosurgical societies. Everyone was doing their own thing independently, and there was very little diversity of residents. From the external standpoint, there was a poor service to educational balance. Residents were doing things like drawing labs and pushing patients to CT scanner and all this sort of stuff. Everything was lecture and book-based. We know that there's better ways now. There was very little science of education. There was no professionalism or communication education. We didn't really think about caring for the caregiver. And I can think of several instances of resident suicide in Chicago in these times because we really weren't paying attention to people who were overstressed and failing. And we didn't train the trainers. There wasn't much education of the educators. There was mass chaos, and duty hours were finally changed in 2003. A lot of this was driven by the ACGME, the national governing body, and they did it in the usual ways from a top-down centralization standpoint. The United States Neurosurgery was really sort of an outlier and considered the bad boy of the team and really didn't cooperate initially, but we eventually came together and we became coordinated, and we created a thing called the summit where everyone would come together and figure out who was going to do what. So part of the problem was that there's a lot of neurosurgery organizations. The SNS, founded by Harvey Cushing, is the first society. Dean DeWitt Lewis was the first vice president. And they were doing everything initially. And then everyone's come to decide that really all the SNS is going to do is U.S. resident and fellow education. AANS was the second society, and then they're really going to do education and advocacy. The Academy's really focusing on research. The ABNS, really certification, the interurban, the NSA, the CNS, all education. So there was a time when everyone was doing a little bit of everything, and the summit really helped to organize that. So when we look at the timeline of the changes, we start off in 1999 with the ABNS starting maintenance of certification. That was a national trend, and we did it starting in 99. The Society of Neurological Surgeons created CAST. Before this, fellowships really weren't very well accredited. It was difficult to say what fellowship was good and what wasn't. The SNS really jumped on this, and it's turned into a huge success. The 80-hour work week started in 2003. The summit started in 2010. In 2009, neurosurgery took over its intern year. Before that, it was run by general surgery. So we realized that we needed to train residents who were brand new, green, right out of medical school. And that's what started the boot camp courses. The 7-year residency started in 2012. Before that, you could do 6 or 7. And then in 2013, milestones, and then 2018, that was revised. And then we started to get into quality projects in 2019. Just breaking up who did what and how they did it, the ABNS had a lot of contributions in this time, and Linda was a part of that. Langston's a part of that. The ABNS was established in 1940 as a reaction because the American College of Surgeons was about to start certifying neurosurgeons. The American College of OB-GYN was talking about certifying neurosurgeons. So thankfully, the neurosurgeons came together and organized themselves. Paul Busey was actually the first secretary of the ABNS and later became chair. So you had to do 1 year of internship, 3 years of residency. That later changed to 4 years. 36 months of neurosurgery came in 1979. And now it's 84 months. Of which 54 months have to be in core neurosurgery training. And the most variability comes in those 30 months of electives. Those may come from research. It may come from PhD work. It may come from internal fellowships. The ABNS written board, thankfully, has changed a lot. The boards that I took, Marvin took, a lot of other people in the room took, were really more factoid. So every year you would have to rememorize the glycogen storage diseases and your lipid storage diseases. And I'm pretty sure that none of you have ever seen a lipid storage consult in the emergency room, but for some reason that would dominate the neurosurgery ABNS written boards. All of that has been gotten rid of. Now we do a really thorough job of asking the question, is this a factoid? Is it clinically relevant? And we've just been getting rid of that stuff. So it's much more clinically relevant, but at the same time, we're asking for higher and higher pass rates. The neuroanatomy exam, residents have taken this. I don't know how many attendings here have taken this. It's not easy. I'm a cranial neurosurgeon, most of it's cranial, and it's not easy. It's tiny microsurgery, but we do ask residents to get to 100%. We've just softened that to 95%. You get 3 attempts. There's only 3 sources, so it's a limited source. You can actually get it done, but it's good to see that residents are starting off with the same baseline of neuroanatomy. And in reality, we're applied neuroanatomists as surgeons. So it begs the question: if ChatGPT can pass our boards, why do we really even need to have written boards anymore when you can just pull something up? And the answer to that is, well, ChatGPT isn't always right. In fact, sometimes it'll hallucinate and give you something that's really, really wrong. So it is important for you to carry around your own level of basic knowledge. And it also begs the question, well, why couldn't ChatGPT write these questions? And the answer is, it can. Doug Kanzioka and his team, especially Eric Orman, have figured out ways to get their own large knowledge model to work with ChatGPT to figure out how to write questions for the ABNS. And we just approved doing this last month. So we're going to be writing questions through ChatGPT. They're not going to be scored. They're actually very good questions. If anybody has written a question, it's not easy. We have to come up with 10 every year. And anybody that's written these questions, to come up with a fair question that passes the muster of the ACGME is it's not easy. So we're going to have these things on the exam. They are not going to be part of the score. We're just going to do a trial and see how people do with these questions. The oral boards, thankfully, have changed as well. Like I said, in the old days, anybody could show up with any crazy case that only you are seeing and other people are not seeing, and you could fail on the basis of that case. That's all been changed. These are now standardized questions. Resident applicants or candidates for ABNS certification are asked to submit 125 sequential cases with imaging with 3-month follow-up. And now the pass rates are about 80 to 90%. I think the boards are far more fair than they used to be, far more fair. We're also asking people to submit their first 10 cases in practice. This allows us to get an initial look at candidates' cases right out of the chute when they start their practice, so that we don't find out that there's a problem after 125 cases. So I think that's a good idea just for that initial check. And people who are going astray, well, they're going to get a phone call from either me or Paul Camerata from the Credentials Committee, just asking them what's going on, why are you having problems? And I can tell you from the sample size that I've seen, it's almost always people have taken a bad job. It's not necessarily they're a bad neurosurgeon. They took a bad job. They're in an isolated place with no senior mentorship. Their healthcare system is demanding that they take care of everything from mid-basilar aneurysms to spondylolisthesis. They don't know how to push back against that. Some of these folks just need to get a different job, or they need to find senior mentorship. Collecting all these cases gives us an amazing look at early practice. So the post cases, this is what everyone submits all of their cases, their 125 cases into. We're now over 100,000 cases. So we get a really close look at what people are doing in their early practice. So this is going to give us an idea of cranial versus spinal, adult versus peds. Where are people taking positions? I can tell you that academic positions are going way up. Private practice is going extinct. People are either joining healthcare systems, or they're joining, say, UCLA opens up or takes a hospital somewhere in the community and now is staffing that hospital. It also gives us a look at reoperations, complications rates, safety, quality indices. It's really an interesting thing to study. Oral boards are better. And one more thing that I think that is better is COVID forced us to go virtual. And I don't think we're ever going back. I don't think that oral boards are going to be in person anymore, besides the fact that it's expensive, time consuming, et cetera, for the candidates. It's a hot seat environment when you have somebody come in and they're sitting with two directors. No matter how nice the directors are, it just feels like this hot seat environment, and you see people artificially do poorly because of that artificial environment. I just think right now that the Zoom format is just easier for people to get through from an anxiety standpoint. We're also doing some proactive things for candidates. We're trying to help them out in their early career. We're distributing the most definitive literature for surgical indications. People get in trouble for surgical indications, particularly spine. We're starting to distribute these CC literature to people ahead of time. We're going to start that here in the spring. And then we're trying to give them more guidance and reminders on how to avoid being sent to the Credentials Committee where people who are having trouble go. So regarding the Credentials Committee, I've had a up-close personal look at this for the last few years. This is what happened last year. So we had 63 diplomats and candidates reported to the Credentials Committee, typically by a state board action, typically something went awry, or it might be a medical staff action. And the issues are almost always professionalism and communication. Substance abuse, poor indications, harassment, kickbacks, et cetera, et cetera. This is just typical professionalism issues. And this is really important for the residents to understand. People lose their licenses for professionalism issues, not for technical matters. People don't finish neurosurgery residencies because of professionalism communication, not typically technical matters. So really pay attention to those things. The SNS really stepped up, created a thing called the Summit. The Summit is where everybody, leaders from all of our major societies, come together every 6 months. Then we talk about what are the next set of challenges and what should we do, who should do it. The first challenge that came up after the Summit was formed was milestone. So we had to decide who was going to take this on. This was an ACGME mandate. Nate Selden really took it on. I was part of the milestones committee. Our milestones started out at 48 milestones. We got down to 36, 24, and then we revised it in 2018. We just keep trying to simplify it to make it easier for residency programs to implement, because you can make them as big and complicated as you want, or you can try to simplify. We've really done what we can to simplify. And the milestones are really supposed to be a holistic evaluation of every possible evaluation that a resident can get. So the clinical competency committee of every residency program comes together every 6 months. It's supposed to be a biopsy of where the resident is at that moment in time. And it's graded 1 through 5, with 5 being fellowship level. Ideally, people will get to 4s everywhere. You can graduate having not reached 4s, but the goal is to reach 4s in everything. To support the milestones and to acknowledge the fact that neurosurgery was taking on the PGY 1 year, we created the SNS resident courses. This is a combined effort, Tom Arigitano and Nate Selden. Tom was starting one in Chicago. I was part of that from the beginning, but Tom really led it. And Nate Selden was doing something similar at OHSU. The SNS brought it all together. And for about a decade, every resident in America came to the intern boot camp course. And it was supported by industry. It was hands-on, senior faculty-led, simulation-based, supporting the milestones and acknowledging the fact that it's really hard for residency programs to train all of their residents in the simple EVD, ICP monitor, lumbar drain, et cetera, et cetera. How do you evaluate a shunt, et cetera? Well, we can do all of that together. And that was the effort that started in 2009. And it was all put aside because of COVID, but it's going to start up again. And then there's a PGY2 course. About 90% of residents came for that. There were skill stations, how to open a head, basic spine, et cetera, simulation based, and then a chief resident course. What we saw over time, and I ran these courses for 5 years and then ran the committee that ran them for 4 years, I had a very close look at this, was the residents, and I'm sure it's true of your residents now, really don't want to listen to lectures. This is a post-lecture educational environment that we're in. People don't want to listen to lectures per se. They want to do pre-study and then small group activities and hands-on. So we eventually just put the lectures online and asked for pre-study and then group discussion when you show up. This is something that's really swept through medical education. This article here is 10 years old, but you know, I can tell you at our institution at Rush, it's all flipped classroom now. Now, the problem with flipped classroom is, number one, there's a heck of a lot of upfront work for the faculty to put all these things online. The senior faculty get a little confused about it because they're not used to this. They're used to their lectures. But the biggest risk is flipped classroom can become a skipped classroom. And that's been borne out, particularly around the time of COVID. At most medical schools, board pass rates have dropped in part because people aren't doing the pre-studying. They're not getting the basics in. Nonetheless, I don't think we're going back. At the courses, we would do skills training and assessments. We've gone over a lot of different simulation models over time, and we tend to keep the ones that are best. But we also put together universal checklists, things for residents to take home for every procedure they ever do. There's universal preparations and checklists to go through. There's a microsurgery skill station put together by Bernard Bendock. Obviously, microvascular anastomosis is a rare operation, but it is a good opportunity to practice under the microscope under senior mentorship. So what's really changed is that it's multimodality and simulation-based training as opposed to lecture-based training as it was in the past. And there's plenty of science to prove that this is better learning, just so good, such as long as the simulations are good. I mean, obviously, if the simulations are bad, then the training is going to be bad. I've been a part of a lot of these simulations things, from skills training in the ICU to surgical training, et cetera. And I can tell you the technical training goes a lot better than the professionalism and communications training. It's just difficult to put together simulations or group discussions of professionalism and communication that are meaningful for residents. As far as the science of learning, I think we're getting a lot better at this. This is the Vygotsky social learning theory. essentially, this is, I think, a common sense notion, but there are things that residents can't do and shouldn't be doing. There are things they can clearly do and don't need to do anymore. And then there's this area of the proximal development, zone of proximal development, where they're on a growth curve, they're on a learning curve. And that's where residents should spend most of their time from a technical skills standpoint. There are scales that help assist this. This is the TAG scale. So when you look at TAGs, it's essentially these are things that faculty can do from teach and demonstrate all the way to solo and observe, depending on what the resident is capable of that time. And then keeping track of that so each of the faculty know where the residents need to continue to grow. Mike Haglund ran the SNS courses for 3 years, and he instituted that within the courses. And what he put together was an app. We've actually used it at Rush, but the app is something that the resident and the faculty use after each operation. And it breaks down the operation by stages and says where the resident is at. Are they done? And they really just need to learn that next step to just to develop just an idea of where their learning scale is. So that brings up the question, what makes an expert technical neurosurgeon? There's a lot of machine learning work being done on this, looking at actual surgical video or simulation of surgery videos and breaking down and comparing it to external validation by surgical experts about what makes somebody good. So you'll take novices, intermediate surgeons, and then expert surgeons, and then break down their surgical steps and figure out what makes somebody really good. Now, there's correlation and causation, and they're not the same thing. So one of the correlations for an expert surgeon is speed. So speed correlates, but doesn't cause excellent surgeon. That surgery, that's an important thing for the residents to understand. So getting in under the microscope and just moving your hands around fast is not the answer. The answer is, you know, as surgery becomes intuitive, everything just moves more quickly. But what makes an excellent technical surgeon is no saccades, fluidity of motion, efficiency of motion, that your two hands, your two instruments working together in a clearly organized fashion. When we had to go to a remote course model with the SNS resident courses, obviously there's something lost. The interaction between senior faculty and residents is lost. And it's very difficult to do simulation training remotely. In 2020, we had to do that the first time. We took a look back and roughly half of residents were involved in it rather than all of them. They rated the course good to great about 80%. The costs, of course, dropped dramatically. The faculty hours dropped dramatically, but I'll also say that the quality dropped fairly dramatically because we would ask the programs to do the simulation on their own at their place. And for the most part, it really didn't happen. So we're bringing those courses back. Thankfully, Linda has found the money to make those courses happen as the SNS treasurer. Anyway, so the boot camp courses are back on for July. Professionalism training has always been the most difficult. I love this quote. This is Arthur Conan Doyle from 150 years ago. I believe that this is very true, that you can learn professionalism in a passive way. I do think that by observation, by watching your senior faculty, you can learn. I don't know how well we can train professionalism. We'll get to that in a minute. As far as wellness and 360 evals, historically, these were not really issues. I put this up, this is again from the SNS archives, and talking about neurosurgical wellness. I just read this thing. This is by Cushing. In 1924, Cushing wrote about an occipital meningioma by good fortune totally removed. I wish I could say as much for the last case of supracellar tumor, which I lost on the table from a torn carotid. I have not had such an accident for 10 years, and it almost made me give up surgery as a job. So imagine Harvey Cushing, 4 years after founding the SNS, thinking about leaving neurosurgery over an intraoperative disaster. Understand that even a person like Harvey Cushing, who we all think of being this godlike figure that could do anything and wasn't bothered by anything, well, you know, these things bother everybody. And I think it's useful that we're doing this sort of caring for the caregiver, worrying about how people are feeling as they're taking care of patients in neurosurgery. As far as 360 evaluations, obviously these were not really things. It wasn't a thing when I was a resident either. The earliest example of a 360 evaluation I could find in the SNS archives was this. This is about Alfred Adson, who started the neurosurgery program at Mayo Clinic. He was a good surgeon of the Western type. On occasions, he was fuming and bombastic until his staff cured him by taping some of his tirades and playing them back to him. He also did a little fuming when he retired, but his early death seemed to justify it. So every time you use an Adson dissector or an Adson clamp or something, think of this. That's Alfred Adson. But there really was very little feedback for residents or senior faculty on their behavior. As far as training professionalism, there's a lot of literature, general surgery literature, et cetera, about training professional. And this is the NYU group. They did a really deep dive into training professionalism. They really made an effort. They believe that you can train professionalism and that you can get improvements in things like communication and interactions within the team. I think that's probably true, but I can say, as we were discussing last night, a lot of professionalism comes in with your parents between the ages of 0 and 6, as Langston put it last night. And some of that it's tough to make up for it if it didn't happen when you were young. We put this together based on our SNS resident courses experience, just saying that it was more difficult. The surveys of the professionalism and communication modules always underperformed the skills simulations. You know, in the end, I have often referred residents to some of the books written by neurosurgeons that I personally know and trust on communication and professionalism in neurosurgery. There's been changes in the match, and I really think that this was a major advance. Lola Chambliss is running our SNS medical student committee right now, and I think Lola's done a great job along with her committee. The first change was preference signaling. Preference signaling was, I think, essential because resident applicants were applying to 80 to 100 programs. So how do you know that somebody's actually interested in your program and wants to match? So if somebody gets 80 interview invites, well, that just means that other people are getting fewer interview invites, and they might remotely do 40 of those. So there's this disproportionate distribution of interviews. So preference signaling, a year ago, we did 8, so five outside of your external rotations and three of your rotations that you did. We've changed that to 25. Based on the experience of orthopedic surgery, we listened to what they did. There was a lot of satisfaction among resident applicants and the residency programs. We'll see how it does this year. It seems to be better because it does seem to match people to where they want to be. A cap on externships was placed a year or two ago, just suggesting that there be 2 external rotations and 1 home rotation. That's a recommendation. The SNS does not have control over what medical students do, but that's a recommendation. We have a universal release date for interviews. There was a time a few years ago where resident applicants had to have their phone with them at all times, because if they didn't sign up for that interview immediately, those interview spots would be gone. We went to the Zoom model for the last couple of years because of COVID, but the transition seems to be going back to people being on site. Is this on site now for you guys? You're still Zooming? Yeah, I personally. Yeah, I personally don't have a problem with that. When you think about it, all the travel really, it's a disadvantage for people who can't afford to do all the travel. And then you have all this travel, so you go to 20 programs, and then you go back for 10 second looks. The second looks are a problem too, which we're trying to rationalize. Second looks, what we always tell resident applicants is, you do a second look for you, not for us. We're not going to grade you based on whether you came back for a second look. But I think that has to be rationalized. And then there's a standardized letter of recommendation, really more of a checkbox with some text. And then looking at this, Lola actually took a look at this with an AI program and looked back, and there's, you know, certain words that are predictive of matching well, and it's, you know, it's sort of predictable. It's, you know, AOA and excellent and outstanding, et cetera. So this is a paper we did a couple of years ago in trends in US neurosurgery residency over the last decade. And the first trend you'll notice is there's a lot more interest in the topic. So there's a lot more peer-reviewed publications about neurosurgery education. There's also a lot more cases being done, or at least being submitted for review by the RC. And those cases, the growth curve really is in endovascular and in spine surgery. And some of that has to do with the switch from 6 to 7 years, but some of it is that we're just tracking things much better. Demographic trends, the number or the percent of women in neurosurgery residency training in 2009 was 12.7%. By 2018, 17.3%. And today it's over 20%. I don't have the most recent number, but it's well over 20% now. The number of programs went from 100 to 115. It's now 121. Regarding women in neurosurgery, this is an AI rendering, by the way, of the future of neurosurgery, and the AI chose a woman for it. I also like that the woman's left-handed, being a lefty myself. And by the way, left-handers are highly disproportionately represented in neurosurgery. It's roughly twice expected. The WINS committee does a great job of keeping track of what's attracting women to neurosurgery and what's keeping them out of neurosurgery. I do have a stake in this. This is my family. My wife's a neurologist. I have two daughters in medical school right now. One's planning on being a neurologist and the other one a neurosurgeon. And this is my daughter having done her first burr hole as an M2 at Northwestern there on the right. So I'm watching this very carefully. And obviously I'm getting feedback from her all the time about what's attracting to her, attractive to her and not attractive to her about neurosurgery. Regarding match rates and so on, it's pretty stable. The overall match rate's about 60%. The overall US MD match rate's about 80%. What is, I think, still disturbing is there's an attrition rate of about 2.6% per year, and you average that over a 7-year residency. The attrition rate's roughly 18%. I don't know the breakout of how many leave of their own accord or not of their own accord. I can tell you for sure that of those that leave not of their own accord, it's almost always professionalism and communication issues. And then a couple of more things just to think about and maybe discuss after I'm done here. We're just about done. The question of 7-year program. We were one of the last programs to go 7 years. We were at 6. We felt we could get it done. Our residents were getting 1,500 cases done in 6 years. The average of a 7-year program is about 1,100. So we thought, well, what are we going to do with that extra year? So we wrote a couple of papers on this recently based on a survey we did. 121 programs, 91 responded. We asked, what are you doing with that 7th year? And I can tell you what it's evolving into. It's largely evolving into an internal fellowship. So that's really what's happening. And the growth of infolded fellowships has been exponential since the 7th year was added in, mostly spine, endovascular, functional neuro-oncology, and so on. And if you look at the number of programs who are doing this and how many infolded fellowships there are, I mean, there's a couple of programs out there with 9 infolded fellowships, 5, 6, 4, 3, pretty common. So infolded fellowship seems to be what's happening, which begs the question, well, I mean, couldn't you really get the training done in 6 years? If what you're really doing is forcing a fellowship, and then people go off and do yet another fellowship. And then when you add in the problem of, well, about 60% of people who get into medical school now are doing at least 1 gap year, 1, 2, or 3 gap years. And then 30% of residents, or I'm sorry, 30% of medical students who match a neurosurgery are doing a research gap year. And then you add a 7-year residency and maybe a fellowship, and then you're board certified 3 years after all of that. So we're pushing right now to people being board certified at the age of 40. At some point, we got to pull back. I mean, that's my opinion. You know, the nice thing about 7 years is you can do an enfolded fellowship. If somebody really is not quite there yet, you can do something else with them. They can do a year of research, et cetera. But I think it does beg the question, you know, when is enough enough as far as stretching out training in neurosurgery to board certification at 40? And now counterbalancing that is the rise of resident unions and the impending duty hour reductions that are probably going to come. The information that I've gotten from the ACGME at the board retreat last month is that we're almost going to, certainly going to see another duty hour reduction. And that will either be 70, 60, or 56. The EU is at 48 hours. So I'll just ask the question of the residents right now. If you had your choice to keep it at 80, but go 6 years, or go to 60 hours or 70 hours and keep it at 7, what would you choose? Because there was a push within neurosurgery to consider maybe a 6-year versus 7-year option. And that literally just died at the ABNS retreat last month because of this issue right now. So what's happening now is we're probably going to go to a shorter work week. So these unions, they're all SEIU based, are in 8 states now. Northwestern just became union last week. And, you know, this is on the website, the SEIU website. These are the issues that they're saying. But, you know, in asking people last night at dinner, the primary benefit, what you've seen, is probably more in the ways of salary and stipends for living and so on. So with that, I hope to stir up a little bit of discussion for both amongst the faculty and the residents. So in looking back at the initial problems that I mentioned from 2005, I put green here at things where I think we really did make some progress. And I left in white some things that I think still need to be worked on. So showing the way in residency and early practice, we are working on the early practice model from the ABNS standpoint. Showing the way in residency is individualized, residency by residency. I mean, you can show somebody their milestones, but you know, what does that really mean in a tangible way for each resident? I do think that we still have work to do on the diversity of residents. We still have work to do with science of education and training professionalism and also training the trainer. So, you know, when I think back about what would Paul Busey think of neurosurgery training now, having had literally a 50-year career in neurosurgery, and, you know, going from being in Ottfried Forster's operating room, holding a lamp, wearing a suit at the beginning of his training, to the CT scan at the end. This is literally the first CT scan ever to show a brain tumor there in the right frontal lobe. Having seen all of that, all of the change and all of the evolution, and the fact that, you know, his residents all excelled in areas that he did not teach them, I think he would understand the evolution of clinical practice and the evolution of education will go hand in hand. So in conclusion, I would just say that we've had imperfect but real progress. There's still lots to do and lots to debate, but I do think that we are making an impact. So thank you for your attention. I'm looking forward to Q&A.
Langston. Yeah, great talk, Rich. It's great having you at the forefront and helping to push these things and to protect our field and do all the things you've been doing. So thank you for that. One thing that we've seen certainly here, as you mentioned, is the increase in women residents. You know, we're at probably over 40% in our program, which I don't know where that is nationally, but I'm sure it's probably in the upper part of it. And you mentioned in your talk somewhere about 12% to over 20% now since like 2009. So almost maybe close to doubling, depending on what the number is. Where we've still struggled both in our program and nationally is those from underrepresented groups have been totally flat during that same time period. What are your thoughts? What are you guys doing at Rush to help kind of increase diversity from those underrepresented in medicine? And what do you think nationally that we can do or should be doing to kind of get that flat curve more an upward going trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, the easy answer is it's a pipeline issue of
people. Those folks need to get into medical school before we can rank them. So there's a pipeline issue. So there's a delayed response of getting people into the right colleges, the right pre-med curriculum, and then into medical school. You can't match somebody who isn't there. So I think that's part of the problem. I mean, we have three African-American residents right now, and we've graduated many. I mean, that's not a problem for us at all. But I know for some programs, it is a problem. And I think that there's an all or nothing phenomena that we've seen. So our African-American resident applicants who get on our website and see three other African-American residents feel like, yeah, this is maybe a place where I'll feel like I fit in. Whereas that might not be the case in the Great Plains programs, who knows? I also think that that's a phenomenon with women. And my daughter strongly confirms that. So we graduated five women through the years, and then we had a stretch where we had no women in our residency program. So you get on our website and it looks like a fraternity house. And you know, half the guys in our program played sports in college, and it looks like literally like a locker room, and smells like one at times too. So some women really just didn't feel comfortable being the first into that crowd. And I can tell you, 7 years in a row, we ranked a woman number one, and they didn't rank us number one. And they went to places like OHSU, Nate Selden, a good friend of ours. I mean, I was visiting professor there in October, and more than half of the residents are women. So there's this phenomenon of more tends to bring more. So places like UCLA, OHSU, lots, and then Rush, we can't get one. We have the last couple of years. And, you know, I thought, well, I'm going to have to wait for one of my daughters to go into neurosurgery. You know, Sasha was interviewing with us last year. She saw that. I mean, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but when you get on the website and it's all guys, yeah, that might be a deterrent for women to even apply.
Your point, you know, they've done studies and they've seen that if you look at people from underrepresented groups, they tend to concentrate in certain programs. And so there's programs that have a history of having a significant number, and then there's others that have no history. And it's really an interesting kind of curve the way that looks. So,
yeah, and I do think some of it is the all or nothing phenomenon. Some of it is, I think some people want to be in Chicago and don't want to be in Nebraska. And that might be a demographic choice, or it might be other. I don't know.
Great talk, Dr. Byrne. I have a question regarding the reduction in duty hours from a national neurosurgery leadership level. Do you think that people are considering that we're not doing as much in the way of busy work as far as collecting labs in the morning? We have more APPs, and therefore it's an appropriate reduction? Or do you think this is more of a, some people might say, newer generation work-life balance sentiment that's driving the conversation?
Oh, probably both. I can't come with a great argument for either one of them. I think it's probably both. I do think that residents are getting more done now in 80 hours than we used to get back in my training days, because there were times when you became phlebotomy after 10 p.m. or you're putting in all the A lines and now you have neurocritical care doing it and so on. So you're getting more meaningful training. I mean, there was a time when the junior resident's job was to find films, running back and forth to the film vault and picking up films, and then chasing down Dr. Berger and saying, "Dr. Berger, here's the MRI
scan." You had to break into the film vault. It wasn't just getting the films. Yes. The film vault would close at 7 or 8, and yes, so you and your colleagues would break into the UCSF film vault to get the films to show Dr. Berger.
Well, what we
that was
to
part
do,
of the training.
Well, I should tell you, at Cook County, there were certain radiology techs that we could bribe with certain liquors, and they would be our best friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had some here. Wait, name Sandy. We have to always, we have to get good with Sandy.
I want to ask you a little about professionalism issue, nature versus nurture. I think if we just narrow it down this for discussion's sake, indications. I think part of it is if the residency program doesn't teach indications, shame on the program. But someone who has true professionalism problems and is taught that, yet just goes off for monetary reasons or whatever. I just wonder what your opinion is. I personally think that cannot be fixed.
Yeah.
That can be monitored. And good, you know, one thing I think is super powerful here is that we have very good M&M conference, which naturally tends, you have to sit there and present this in front of your peers, and it tends to hold things back. But places, solar practice or other places, may have weak M&M process where people can just go off and veer off and do unindicated operations. I personally don't think you can fix that.
I think you're right. I think that some people are externally motivated, money, prestige, whatever. I also think that there's probably a disproportionate share of those folks attracted to neurosurgery because it's perceived that way. All we can do is that which is fixable. And that is, number one, identify that person, not match them. And then number two, teach those indications, as you pointed out. So that's something that in the ABNS, we have the continued certification. We have all the best literature on indications for everything. And we wait for people to go through their continued certification modules to look at those. We want to be proactive now and send those papers out to people who just finished their residency, who may not really understand that, you know, spinal fusion is there are guidelines for what should be fused and not fused. And I'll tell you, one of the biggest problems we have in spine right now is people come out of these complex spine fellowships where all the discussion is percent correction per level. And it's not about what really needs to get fixed and what doesn't. So you see people say, well, my professor would say I need 11% correction on this level, which means I have to fuse the next level. So some of it is just the confusion of how much of it is sagittal balance and how much of it is, you know, that's a normal level, leave it alone.
Thank you very much for your call. Doctor, what is your opinion? Because majority of the graduates in neurosurgery now, they do spine surgery. What's going to happen? Because you talk about the history. Almost neurosurgery, the brain part is almost going to go on the side, or we have to have only brain neurosurgery and spine neurosurgery. What is your opinion? What is the prediction for the future?
So the post data, I thought it was going to be 75 spine, 25 brain, because that's what I heard. But the post data is 60-40. So there is still a fair amount of brain surgery being done. Spine, it just so happens that there's a lot more discs out there than there are lobes. And I think that ratio kind of drives things. People are outliving their spines now in a way that they're not really outliving their brain. So I think that's part of it. I don't think that's particularly going to go away. I think what's going to really clip the wings of spine surgery eventually is when they do value-based care or bundling. That's going to flip some of that. And people will probably fade a little bit from that. But for now, those are the cases that show up in people's clinic.
So Rich, you mentioned how professionalism issues tend to really be the problems you see with residents, but also faculty as well, for sure. Have you figured out a way to assess for professionalism and, you know, their potential for being good professionals in medical students when you're making your rank list and figuring that out? Because if that's really the main issue, we need to be able to better discern that, right? And how do we, because we see the, you know, CVs and publications, and we see all these things that sometimes drive match lists and things. How do we get back towards looking at those things that are really the determinants of if people are successful and finish the program?
Yeah, as far as professionalism goes, I think it comes down to letters and phone calls. So you have to read the letters written by people that you know and trust. And then when you're really putting your rank list together, you give them a call. Particularly if there's any question at all about, we're not so sure about this person. Because you can easily, if you're not a good person, you can hide that in a 15 or 20 minute interview easily. It's kind of hard to hide that in a month. And it's the residents that usually pick up on it, not necessarily the attendees. Everyone cleans up their behavior around you guys, but with the residents, that's when you really get to know somebody. Right.
There's been a move both in undergraduate and medical education away from standardized testing and away from grades. Is that something that, you know, these boards are paying attention to or are worried about? Do you anticipate that the pendulum's going to swing back the other way?
Yeah, we talked about this last night a little bit. There are some colleges that dropped SAT, ACTs, and now they're coming back to, in part because they don't really know how to. When you get 70,000 applications, like 120,000 applications to UCLA every year, how do you decide? It's impossible. So I think that it's a bit of a pendulum. At the same time, it really takes the pressure off the medical students. I have two daughters in medical school right now. My wife is definitely one of these all over it mothers. And my daughters, all they do is tell her that, you know, they got 100% on every test, 100% mom, 100%. The pressure's gone. They don't have to tell her a number anymore. At the same time, if board scores keep dropping as a result, and that's what has been seen over the last several years, it's really a question of, is the pendulum ever going to swing back? And I don't know that answer. Right now, the only board score we see is the second board. And by then, resident applicants have already decided on their field, and it's almost too late to turn back. So you're gunning for neurosurgery or plastic surgery, ENT, and you get this low board score back, you're really in trouble at that point. Because you're not likely to match in that field, and all the research you've done, all the chatting you've done is in that field. So in a way, it disadvantages the medical students in some way. And then finally, it disadvantages the medical student from a smaller medical school. So instead of people saying, well, that person had a 270, but they're out of Oklahoma, versus the person at Hopkins who had a 320. So that was a way for the person at the lesser known medical school to even up the playing field. Now that's gone.
You mentioned sort of as a great talk, by the way, very interesting. You mentioned also a throwaway that private practice is going extinct.
Yes.
And I think that is a pretty major thing to say in an offhand way. And I wondered if you could elaborate on your thoughts on that, on what's driving it, and whether or not organized neurosurgery can do anything about it, or wants to do anything about it, or should do anything about it.
Yeah, I'm in favor of some private practice in neurosurgery. There ought to always be free range neurosurgery out there somewhere. Okay, because those of us that are captive need something to compare ourselves to, right? So whether you're at UCLA or Sutter or Kaiser, you're captive. And they'll put a restrictive covenant on you. That may eventually come down. So there needs to be something to compare that to. In Cook County, Illinois, we're talking about, I don't know, 5 million people. There's not a single private practice neurosurgeon, not one. 25 years ago, they were everywhere. And it's all financial. The bottom line is our overhead. To be a neurosurgeon in Cook County, your overhead is $400,000 to $500,000 a year. So January 1st, figure I'm writing a check for $400,000 to $500,000. Medicaid is the fastest growing payer. And it's simply the math doesn't work. And what really happened is 1997, CMS took professional fees to neurosurgery, dropped them by 30%. And then at the same time, raised the DRGs for neurosurgery for hospitals by 40%. So the model switched from you're a professional getting professional fees to you're a free agent, like in baseball in the 1970s, where your actual value is bringing people to the stadium being the hospital. So in reality, I know the math on this very well, but in our institution, we get $1 professional fees for every $10 the hospital gets on the admission. It's literally a 10-to-1 ratio. So your value is in bringing people to a hospital. It's not in the operation that you did per se. I don't think that's ever going to change. As long as that ratio is 10-to-1, you know, you're a free agent. You're a person that, that brings patients to a hospital. Now, free agency assumes that you might leave. And if you're unwilling to leave ever, there is no bottom to which you'll be dragged, right? So you have to be a free agent at some point. And it is kind of sad to see private practice disappearing in places like Chicago. I don't know what it's like in LA. Are there real private practitioners out there anymore?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I think part of it is our malpractice is $230,000 a year for one free policy. And I think in California, they have caps, it's probably like 30 or 40.
It's changing.
Yeah.
So the math is more favorable here.
The caps are changing, but like you see, we're self-insured, so it's actually the rates are better.
Yeah.
And I think that's bottom line, right? It's the expenses to be in a, you know, in a group, an academic group or a employed model is actually better than private practice these days.
Mm-hmm. Question that, thank you for your talk, very interesting. A question I got about the duty hours, the comment you made about, you know, it's either to, we either increase the years or keep the numbers of hours high. It's a little bit of a false dichotomy, don't you think? I mean, even now, even if we don't go do phlebotomy, and I'm sure people have seen it in, as attendings too, like the hours that you spend doing administrative work has inflated like year after year, I'm sure, for attendings as well as for residents. And so some of the hours that are being spent are not, you know, true neurosurgical service hours, let alone education. So what are your thoughts kind of about that and what it's medical systems we can do to minimize that?
Well, I mean, there was a time when we had long hours and long residency. If you go to short hours and shorter residency, inevitably you lose experience. So you're just graduating greener and you can say, well, okay, well, in Europe, it's 48 hours. But in Europe, just take a look at what happens in Europe. As an attending, you're essentially the person who opens and closes for the big professor. So you're never really independent until you become the big professor. So your residency has ended, you're a consultant, but you're still under the wing of the big professor. The way it's modeled here, you finish your residency, you can go out anywhere. You can go take a job anywhere. So the question is, what is safe? What level of training is safe? Is it 1,000 cases? Is it 1,500? Is it 500? I mean, there's a gradient there below which maybe it's not safe to go out and practice, particularly for some of the more complicated things.
Yeah, I think like a draw of neurosurgery for everybody is, you know, the commitment to the craft, irrespective of, you know, external work hour considerations and things like that. And to put it like mildly, been relatively unimpressed with interactions with other residency programs that are more adherent to work hours, right? Where work hours are primary consideration. So my question is like, if these things are so divergent, let's say ACGME requirements and work hours and the goals of training to become an expert surgeon by the end of your training, is there any mechanism to like leave the GME or for neurosurgery to have its own organized system?
So we can leave the ACGME and create a specialty surgical board, and that has been discussed recently. That doesn't mean that UCLA neurosurgery can leave UCLA GME. Those are two different things, ACGME and your individual GME. Linda, what would happen to you if you said we're pulling out of the UCLA GME?
You know, we've never tried it.
I'm pretty sure I know what would happen.
Yeah.
That's simply not possible. You're not going to pull out of the California system. You are part of the system. And yeah, you're going to see a variety of dedications among physicians you're going to see it within neurosurgery, between specialties for sure. But yeah, on the national stage, there is discussion about pulling out of ACGME. That's ongoing.
One more. You mentioned that the SNS has a 2 externship recommendation. Mm-hmm. I'm aware of many programs, including ours, who have increasing basically this decision, we're only going to take sub-eyes or preferentially matched sub-eyes. But if you only get 2, the math just doesn't work out very well. And I actually counsel medical students, you should do, really pick your programs and do many sub-eyes because that's your best chance of matching. It seems like the SNS is out of sync with what's actually happening out there in residency program.
So it's a suggestion. It's not, the SNS has no punitive mechanism for telling medical students or programs what to do or not do. These are suggestions that we hope people will follow. At the same time, when I'm advising my own daughter and she says, can I do 3? I say, sure, go ahead. But what it ends up being, though, is that she has less time to do anything else during her 4th year of medical school. So if you thought you would do a month of critical care, well, you're not going to do that month. You're doing neurosurgery then.
Doctor, thank you very much. About the professionalism, I taught in this medical school for almost 20 years, different years with the students. There are students who have problems. Whatever you do, whatever you say. Dr. Yang was in my class years ago. And
I was a bad student.
And fortunately, school is the one. They don't want to get bad reputation to drop the students financially or also lawsuit. There was one student, I never forget. For 2 years, that student tried to pass the 1st year. She had problem. And the school, they knew she had so much problem. And they didn't do anything. They said, don't say anything. Otherwise, she's going to sue. She has told them, if you touch me, maybe sue.
Yeah.
This is the problem. I think the medical school should be more cautious about training, but some people, you can't change them. This is their nature, very rigid. All of us know, not that you are bad, they don't fit to medical field from the professional point of view.
Well, that's a universal problem. I'll just comment that you can't live in fear of lawsuits. In neurosurgery, you have to take risks. In medical training, you have to take risks. And as a chair, I've been sued. I was sued by a residency program coordinator who I fired because she wouldn't show up before 11:30 in the morning, and she's supposed to show up at 8. And we went through every process of you can't, you have to. And then finally, I fired her. And then within a day, I had a lawsuit on my desk suing me for discrimination because she was depressed, and I should have known she was depressed. I mean, you can't stop that sort of thing. And by the way, my institution, I wanted to go to court. I'm like, I'll meet you in hell. I'll meet you in court. It doesn't matter. This is ridiculous. Okay. Everyone, I'll take you on rounds through the ICU and I'll show you depression. Okay. You just don't want to come in the morning. Okay, fine. But our institution settled it. And they just kind of laughed at me and said, well, you know, Rich, this is Cook County. 95% of these go for the plaintiff no matter what we do. So we're just going to write him a smaller check than we'd have to in court. And that's just part of the cost of doing business.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send any questions or comments you have to Ausman@snidigital.org. This program is from the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery. Linda Liao, the chairwoman and its faculty, and is supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, owner of SNI and SNI Digital, and by the Waymaster Corporation, producers of the Leading Gen television series, Silent Majority Speaks, Role Models, and the Medical News Network. Thank you.